This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Every 4 years, as presidential candidates roam across the snow-covered fields of Iowa, we all get to hear about the pros and cons of spending billions of taxpayer dollars subsidizing ethanol production. Well, come Sunday, that debate is over for good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. Thanks for joining us for the Marketplace podcast on this Thursday. It is the 29th of December, 2011. A year in which Congress didn't accomplish a whole lot. And it's one of the things lawmakers didn't do that's about to affect a powerful industry come Sunday. Congress chose not to extend a subsidy that encourages the production of ethanol. For decades, producers have received what's called a blender's tax credit. For every gallon of ethanol they make, they're eligible for a 45-cent tax credit. Well, in 3 days, that subsidy is history, as Marketplace's David Gura reports from Washington.
The government's been at this for a while now. Chris Knittel teaches energy economics at MIT.
We've been subsidizing ethanol since at least 1978.
What's Texaco doing in a field of corn? Not growing it. Texaco's making gasohol. It's a mixture of 90% Texaco unleaded gasoline and 10% ethanol made from renewable crops like corn.
Back then, biofuels were the stuff of the future, another key to energy independence. But there were obstacles. Dermot Hayes is an economics professor at Iowa State. Companies had to invest in new facilities to make ethanol.
It didn't make economic sense to build those kind of plants.
That's because for a while, ethanol and gasoline were both pretty cheap. The blender's tax credit tipped the scales, and Hayes says it's kept them tipped, encouraging the ethanol industry to grow over the last 3 decades.
Given that the industry has been built, the industry can survive without the subsidy.
Especially since the government mandates companies make a certain amount of ethanol every year. That's an issue Republican presidential candidates are arguing about. At the end of 2011, the blender's tax credit will expire, and MIT's Chris Knittel says that's no small thing.
$7 billion a year funneling from taxpayers to ethanol producers and corn farmers, so it's not chump change.
What does it mean for consumers? The demand for corn and the price of corn is probably going to stay high. The U.S. will produce ethanol with or without the subsidy. We'd only see demand change if the price of oil dropped dramatically. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Now, there was one subsidy that Congress did extend last week, the one that goes into all of our paychecks. I'm talking, of course, about the payroll tax cut. After a long and tense back and forth, House Republicans finally agreed to extend the cut as part of a package that also extends long-term unemployment benefits for the next 2 months. Which brings us to a segment we call Attitude Check.
And the latest poll numbers suggest
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said
Frank Newport from the polling firm Gallup is with us now to talk about the winners and losers from the payroll tax debate. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
So how do people feel about this end-of-the-year showdown in Washington?
Well, it can't do much more harm to their image of Congress in general, which on 10 different measures was at record lows this past year. But clearly, Americans probably are happier that the two-month extension was passed than had it not and had the payroll tax cut and the unemployment benefits disappeared on January 1st.
And is there a difference in people's mind between Republicans and Democrats on that front?
This week, we went into the field and asked Americans, who do you have more confidence in when it comes to the negotiations over payroll tax cuts and unemployment benefits? 41% say they would have more confidence in the Dems to handle it, and 34% Republicans, although a quarter of Americans say they don't have confidence in any of the above and are withholding judgment.
Now, it does seem like every time President Obama gets some good political news, it bumps up his numbers for a little bit, and then they come right back down again. Is that going to happen this time, do you think, or is this going to last for longer?
It's already happened. Classic rally effect. You know, Obama's ratings did jump up in our Gallup poll just right around Christmas. Obama's job approval rating went up to 47%. That's the highest reading we have had since last summer. But his ratings have already come back down, and now they're back in the lower 40s about where they were.
Okay, well, I don't think many politicians in Washington are going to make it onto your most admired men and women of 2011 list, but that's where I want to go next because I'm told there are some business leaders on that list.
This year, for the first time in our history, and this goes back to 1948, of asking Americans, who's the man living anywhere in the world that you most admire, we have three business leaders on the list this year. And I might ask you, who do you think they are?
I would have to guess that Warren Buffett is probably on that list.
Very good. You get a gold star for that. In fact, Warren Buffett, this is the first time he's been on the list. He's number five. He's followed by Donald Trump, and I assume we consider him a businessman. He's an entertainer and a wannabe politician, but underneath it all, he's a real estate mogul, no doubt about that. And for the 13th time on the list, Bill Gates is among the top 10 most admired men that Americans tell us on our list.
And what about the most admired women of 2011?
Oprah Winfrey appears second on the list behind Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton wins. Is she a businesswoman? Well, she's an entertainer. But she's worth hundreds of millions, has her own network, not a classic CEO like Carly Fiorina or someone like that. But nevertheless, she's second on the list.
All right. Well, Frank, I want to ask you one more thing while we've got you here, and that is the Iowa caucuses are just right around the corner. What's going to happen?
It's just very difficult to try to predict what's going to happen. One thing we do know for sure that voters in Iowa, despite being conservative, are being driven by the economy and jobs. And, of course, nationally, when we look at the data, it's going to be the economy and the perceptions of who can best handle the economy that we still think is going to drive the ultimate winner of the GOP nomination.
All comes back to the economy. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Our partnership with them is called Attitude Check. You can go to our website for more. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Traders had a pretty good attitude on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The largest internet company in China has just hired a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. And the rumor is that Alibaba needs lobbyists because it wants to buy Yahoo. Yahoo has been struggling lately, and a takeover might be just the ticket for a turnaround. But one of America's biggest internet companies getting taken over by a Chinese company is guaranteed to raise red flags in Washington. And that's where the lobbyists come in, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
When a company in China wants to buy its American counterpart, it needs advisors, investment bankers to get the right price, lawyers to cover all the regulations, and, oh yeah, a lobbying firm to do battle in Washington?
It's essentially the old Cold War enemies. China's a rising power, and so there's some suspicion that the Chinese really are trying to spy on us. So that's created somewhat of an issue.
Roger Kay is a technology analyst with Endpoint Technology Associates. He says the internet may intrinsically be a national security issue.
They could propagandize and influence things. A lot of people read Yahoo, so perhaps that would be an issue. So there's certainly some way that some congressman or senator could raise an objection if they wanted to.
The U.S. government let one prominent tech deal fizzle. Bain Capital in Boston tried to sell 3Com, a company that held some national security contracts. The proposed buyer? China's Huawei Technologies. The Department of Defense suggested Huawei had ties to China's military and potentially hackers. The deal died. Clay Lowery chaired the government committee that oversaw that merger. He's now a vice president with Rock Creek Advisors.
The government has plenty of operations that utilize the internet and utilize information technology. So those are the type of areas, at least, that you would want to look at if you're in the U.S. government.
Yahoo may not have government contracts, but it stands between consumers and the wider internet. That means it would get a lot of scrutiny. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
What do you really know about the proposed Keystone XL oil pipeline? The one that would bring a certain type of oil called oil sands or tar sands from Canada to the United States. One thing we know is that the pipeline has become a political hot potato in Washington. And as with everything that becomes a big political issue there, some of the facts get lost in translation. Marketplace's Scott Tong from our sustainability desk has been to the oil sands and has this reality check.
Let's first pick on pipeline opponents. Their starting point is Canadian oil sands are dirty. Yes, it takes extra energy to steam it out of the ground. But Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations looks at the whole life of a drop of oil. And extraction is not the main issue.
Most of the emissions associated with oil come when you burn it in your car. So it's a distraction to some degree to focus on the emissions that come when you get it out of the ground.
Still, one climate scientist says there's so much oil sands in Canada, it'll be game over for planet Earth. All right, let's say companies produce a whopping 10 million barrels of the stuff someday.
10 million barrels a day, it would take you till the year 3316 to extract all that oil.
University of Alberta economist Andrew Leach. He says in 1,000 years, other fuels like coal will have done far more damage.
To make it a case where oil sands production, if we stop it, then we somehow make a meaningful difference in the global emissions trajectory. I don't see how that really makes sense.
Surely the renewables argument makes sense, that we need a policy to promote them. Amen, says Amy Myers Jaffe at Rice University. Thing is, weaning in energy time takes decades.
In the immediate term, we have over 260 million automobiles on the road that use oil-based fuel. And we're going to need oil to supply all those cars.
Which is what the Keystone XL promoters want to hear. One of their big talking points is Canadian oil is ethical oil. From your friends to the north.
To a good extent, it is symbolic.
Again, Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations.
It may make people feel better to know that they bought their oil from a good guy rather than a bad guy. But so long as they're buying a lot of oil, they're propping up world prices and helping the bad guys get money.
Lately, Ottawa has been making this threat. If America doesn't want our oil, we'll sell it to China. Except that it's already on the way there, says Calgary economist Peter Terzakian.
There's pretty much unanimity within the Canadian oil and gas industry that we need to diversify our markets beyond one customer, that we need to participate in global growth markets, not singular, stagnant markets.
Finally, Keystone fans say it will bring pipeline employment. Yeah, some, says Andrew Leach.
And it's thousands of construction jobs over the course of the building of the pipeline and hundreds of operation jobs, but it's not going to have a meaningful impact on the U.S. unemployment rate.
He finds many pipeline job projections
wildly exaggerated.
No surprise, in an overheated election year fight over one pipeline. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, what will we be reflecting on next December?
For the first time, the leprechaun at the end of the rainbow made Forbes' world's richest people list.
It could happen. But first, let's do the numbers. No worries today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials bounced back after yesterday's declines. The Dow was up 135 points, or 1 1/10% to close at 12,287. The NASDAQ rallied 23 points, nearly 1%, wrapped up at 26.13. The S&P 500 bungeed back up by 13 points, slightly better than 1%, ending at 12.63. Some fresh, encouraging economic data helped lift financial stocks. Bank of America shares recovered almost all they lost in yesterday's slide. JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo each climbed more than 2%. A report from the National Association of Realtors showed a jump of more than 7% in pending home sales that sent KB Home up 6%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Department of Agriculture releases farm prices for December, the amount farmers receive for livestock and crops. The House and Senate meet in pro forma sessions, brief meetings where no actual business is conducted. And it's December 31st in Samoa and Tokelau. That's right, the two countries in the South Pacific are skipping December 30th and time traveling to New Year's Eve. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson, in for Kai Rizdal. If you were to go to the original home of the Occupy Wall Street movement today, Zuccotti Park in New York City, you might find a handful of protesters, but nothing like the tent city that was set up there a couple months ago. In fact, in cities across the country, the public face of Occupy Wall Street is now much harder to find. But the movement's message about income inequality and injustice remains. And it's a message that some religious leaders are embracing, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Forgive me for what is quite possibly blaspheming, but to hear some preachers from the pulpit these days, you'd think the arrival of Occupy Wall Street is tantamount to the second coming.
So we have to look in the unlikely places that we might not even expect to hear a word from God.
That unlikely place to hear the word of God was the Occupy encampment in Portland, Oregon. The Reverend Chuck Curry started helping out as a pastor, then led an ecumenical vigil just before police busted up the protest. In this sermon, delivered at his congregational church, Curry draws a direct scriptural line from the Old Testament to Occupy.
So listen to this, Isaiah chapter 58. If you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness.
A quick check online found ministers sermonizing on Occupy in Berkeley, Boulder, Worcester, Mass., Edmonton, Alberta.
Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt.
Curry says it's the most significant spark for Christian activism against poverty since the civil rights movement.
Occupy has done a job that we have been unable to do, which is capture the public's attention and imagination to make it part of the national debate again.
It's usually problematic to try to identify Jesus Christ with any particular political or economic agenda.
Mark Tooley heads up the Institute on Religion and Democracy. It monitors what it calls the religious left. Tooley says Jesus did tell his disciples to give up their possessions for the needy. Still,
you really would be hard-pressed to find any kind of direct evidence that Jesus ever called upon or even implied that the rulers should use all the extraordinary powers of the government to take wealth from one group of people and to give it away to another group of people.
Tooley says some Christians may buy the Jesus as economic radical image, but most will be turned off by the Occupy style.
Taking over a public property and disrupting traffic and commuters. I think that kind of imagery is disturbing, especially to church-going America, who tend to be more orderly and have very strong views about following the rules and the law.
Reverend Curry responds.
The religious right, they've endorsed the inequality that exists. They preach something called prosperity theology that says that if you play by the rules and do things the way they think you should do them, then you'll get wealthy. I certainly don't read the Bible that way.
All this leaves middle-of-the-road Christians, well, stuck in the middle. Ministers I talked to, from mainline Protestants to evangelicals, said many in their congregations want to do something, but they're not ready to become social activists or occupiers either. Dan Paxton is pastor of a Baptist church in Portland. The congregation's trying to expand its food pantry and give out warm clothes to homeless people. And yet, Paxton finds himself uncomfortable focusing too much on troubles in this world at the expense of rewards in the next.
Through the Occupy movement, people are searching for something. And for lack of anything else, they search for material possessions. You know, they're saying they're the 99%. Well, I'm a part of the 99% too, but I don't struggle with knowing what I need because I know I need the Lord more than anything. So I struggle with what to do for them.
In Portland, Oregon, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you want to get an idea of how the Eurozone debt crisis is going, you can check European stock markets. They were up today. You can check European bond markets and see how much each country has to pay to borrow money. Borrowing costs have been relatively low this week. You can also check how the euro currency is stacking up against other currencies. And today, the euro hit its lowest level against the dollar since September of 2010. But to get the big picture, we're going to turn now to the man who's been our principal guide through the crisis. That would be Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London, who joins us for a Euro Year in Review. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Jeremy.
So I guess the big question we have to start with is this crisis in Europe has been going on for a couple of years now. Why hasn't it been solved?
It hasn't been solved because it's not one crisis, but three. The three crises are, first of all, a government debt crisis. Some of these governments in the Eurozone are struggling to pay their way. There's also a banking crisis with lots of big banks in the Eurozone sitting on potentially huge losses from the government bonds they're holding. And it's a currency crisis with 17 countries all linked together in the one currency, with the danger that if one of them falls off the mountain, there's a danger he'll pull the others off after him.
And I guess if we're looking back at 2011, we really have to look back at Greece. How are they doing?
Well, Greece is tiny. It's only 2% of the Eurozone economy. But Greece hasn't begun to solve its problem yet because it's in this currency union. Let's look at what would have happened if Greece had its own currency again, the drachma.
Okay.
So it defaults. Its central bank then prints a ton of drachmas to keep the country's banks from going bust, and it devalues its currency. A slump in the value of the drachma makes Greece's exports much cheaper. It also makes Greece a much cheaper holiday destination. And in time, after some pain and disruption, the Greek economy begins to grow again. But trapped inside the Eurozone, Greece can't default because the big countries in the Eurozone that lent it the money, principally France and Germany, they have forbidden Greece from defaulting. So Greece is locked into this downward spiral.
And you mentioned Germany and France, the two biggest economies. They've been making a lot of the decisions when it comes to dealing with the European debt crisis. How have they done this year?
In a word, badly. And I think that's an almost universal judgment. It's all been slightly reminiscent of this curious case of mass hysteria in the European city of Strasbourg in the early 16th century, the dancing plague. hundreds of people took to the street and started dancing. And the local authorities decided the best way to deal with this was to hire some musicians.
Let them dance even more.
Indeed. It didn't really work. Up to 400 people in the end danced non-stop for a month. Now, Germany and France have done something a bit similar over the debt crisis. They have insisted on countries like Greece cutting their public spending, reducing their debt. They've made matters worse. It's the dancing plague all over again.
So as we look forward to 2012, is the music going to stop for Europe? Is the euro going to fall apart or is it going to stay together?
When I was in Brussels recently, I met a politician who's absolutely convinced the euro is doomed. In fact, he keeps a coffin with a euro painted on the lid in his office. He's Nigel Farage, head of the UK Independence Party. Here's what he thinks of the euro.
The euro itself is what has caused the problem. The euro is the problem.
He says currency unions usually do fall apart. If this one will is very much an open question, but it's a fairly safe bet that this currency union will survive quite a while longer. And my most confident prediction for the new year, Jeremy, is we'll certainly be talking about this again in 2012.
Well, at least we've got you to help guide us through it. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks so much and Happy New Year.
And you, Jeremy.
Okay, so you've heard a million bests and worsts for 2011, some of them right here on Marketplace, but that's not what we're going to do now. Right now, we're going to get a head start on the reflecting we'll be doing in a year. Here now is humorist Christina Wong with a sneak peek at what we'll be talking about on December 31st, 2012.
In January, corporations unsuccessfully attempted to thwart the Occupy Wall Street protesters by inflating the price of oil, specifically patchouli oil. In February, the diminishing ozone layer caused hell to freeze over. In June, the White House formed a fiction writing club, formerly known as the Supercommittee, to attempt again to balance the national budget. Some of the lesser-known features of their 340-page budget plan included a $15 line item to purchase the Governing for Dummies book and Sudoku solutions on page 101. In July, the repo man from the East, a.k.a. China, demanded America pay back our $1.16 trillion debt in full. This shakedown devastated all Americans, especially the poor, the 13 Americans that make up the middle class. Even the 1% felt the pinch. And for the first time, the leprechaun at the end of the rainbow made Forbes' world's richest people list. This year saw the election of a president. It's above my pay scale to tell you the winner, but there was an unprecedented number of write-in votes for Siri. But not all Americans suffered in 2012's dark but anticipated downturn. Manufacturers of red ink turned a healthy profit. Americans with the foresight to sneak across the border to work in Mexico thrived. And thanks to the exponential growth of the Occupy Wall Street movement, the stock price of tents, sleeping bags, and polar fleece shot up by 99%. Listeners, if my 2012 predictions worry you, relax. My clairvoyance is as accurate as a fortune cookie. My advice? Say the words in bed at the end of each headline you read next year. It'll make 2012 much more bearable.
Christina Wong is a writer and performer in Los Angeles. You can send us your thoughts or predictions. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says contact.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today as we approach the Iowa caucuses, because of the new campaign finance rules, most of the ads that are blanketing TV stations in Iowa right now aren't paid for by the candidates, but rather by super PACs, outside groups with names like Restore Our Future, Make Us Great Again, and Citizens for a Working America. By the way, that last one was supporting Michelle Bachmann's candidacy. It just made a switch and is now supporting Mitt Romney. I guess the nice thing about having a generic name like Citizens for a Working America, you don't have to really be loyal to anyone. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rebounded 135 points, or 1.1%. The Nasdaq added 23 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 rose 13 points, slightly better than 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Next time, right back here, the Iron Lady's divisive legacy in England.
Dictator, that's what I call her. Dangerous woman.
You weren't a supporter?
No.
We pay a visit to Margaret Thatcher's hometown. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.